Save big at Menards and prepare for the summer heat with a new air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Cool your space from anywhere in the room with three cooling speeds and a remote control. Save big money on Denali Air air conditioners. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. This week on Unforgotten. Over the summer of 2020, friends and family sensed a change in CJ's behavior and overall demeanor. Little did they know that July 28th, 2020 would unravel a sequence of events that would alter their lives forever.
CJ was scheduled at work at 7 a.m., but he never showed up.
Somehow they could tell that he left home with it only 4% charged. Phone had 4% battery.
We got back to the Jeep and we got to call because Rhonda had called me, his aunt, and said that they had found his boots and phone on Center Church Road. I
said, the searches included aerial searches with helicopters and drones, canine searches, volunteers on foot, four-wheelers, ATVs, and side-by-side.
To where his remains were found was almost a mile walk barefoot down a dirt road through an area with pines.
I don't want to think of that. I mean, I didn't want to think that somebody would hurt him, but or take his life.
Hey everyone, this is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten,
where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Be sure to join our Unforgotten Patreon channel today to gain exclusive benefits, including early access to ad-free episodes and bonus content. By subscribing, you'll also be supporting the efforts of ACCA in assisting families and raising awareness for Alabama cold cases.
And now for episode 31, part 2, CJ Wilkinson.
Hey guys, and welcome back. So, Stormy, I've been watching this show on Hulu. I told you it was a Hulu original, but it's not a Hulu original. It comes on FX.
Oh.
It's called A Murder at the End of the World. And it's like totally right up our alley. It's a mystery series centered around a Gen Z amateur sleuth and tech-savvy hacker named Darby Hart. And her dad is like the county coroner where they live. And she has grown up kind of helping him in his job and things like that. And she's just really computer savvy. But she is invited with 8 other people to this like exclusive retreat type thing with this billionaire tech guy and her hero female coder. Just always looked up to her, like all of her stuff. And so anyway, the guy always has these like really exclusive invitation only retreats every year. And he invites these really smart people who are making basically big contributions to the world in some way or another. And they talk about things they can do to help the world in some way or another.
Okay.
Anyway, while they're there, people just start dying.
Oh.
Like, they're being murdered.
Like a whodunit kind of a thing.
But she has it's like a whodunit thing. Kind of like one of those things, like a web sleuth thing where she used to get on these forums and talk to other people. And she met a guy that she actually ended up falling in love with. His name was Bill. But they started on this road trip to identify these Jane Does that they linked to a serial killer. And so they actually did identify one of the Does. And so she wrote a book about this journey that they were doing. And this is what got her invited on this trip. And so now that people are turning up dead, she is like investigating all of this stuff. And it's actually really good. I really like the show. obviously it's not true, but it's really good. It's really interesting.
It's got a lot of different areas that we kind of dabble in. I'll have to check that out. Now, we have a surprise for our listeners if they haven't already seen it on Facebook, right?
Yes, we do. We started working on this like probably a month ago, and we have been sitting on it, waiting to announce it until it actually came out. But we successfully achieved one of our set goals by assisting a family in obtaining a billboard. A yep. big shout out to Wally Billboards for the stunning billboard featuring Lila Faulkner and Troy.
Yeah, it turned out really good.
It did turn out so good. It is absolutely beautiful, and it's huge.
Yeah. So kind of hard to miss if you're in the area. So if you're in the area, please take pictures of it and post it on our page.
Exactly. And if you post it over in the comments on the post on the ACCA page, you could possibly win a free Unsolved t-shirt.
Yeah.
And if you aren't familiar with Leela's case, Leela disappeared on July 4th of 2016 in Troy. And her family is hoping this billboard will encourage anyone with information to come forward.
If you have any information about her disappearance, please contact the Pike County Sheriff's Office at 334-566-4347 or Halo Investigations at 662-664-3057. Your information could lead to a cash reward. So, also, before we jump back into CJ's case, I wanted to share just a couple of thoughts. First, thank you to Sellers for carrying the weight of recording part one and sharing all the beautiful memories that April and Mariah and CJ's friends wanted everyone to hear. I don't know how you stayed composed during the recording. I couldn't.
It's because I deleted all the other ones before you could hear them.
Ah.
It took multiple attempts at recording, and I would start and stop. And so I deleted all of those before you could see all of the fails.
Yeah.
Because it took a lot to get through it.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine. We aren't exaggerating when we say how special the families are that we share are to us. And CJ and his family and friends are no exception at all. I was editing part one of the episode and will fully admit I was just weeping at times.
Yeah.
If you haven't had a chance yet to listen to part one, please go back and listen before starting part two. CJ was just such a great guy.
And get your Kleenexes.
Yeah. It really is important to hear those things, you know, from the family. And we had another call with April and Mariah last night before I started writing the first part of this episode. Thank you to Sellers for finishing it up for me. I had to express to them how honored I and Sellers feel to be able to share CJ's life and his story. Truly, we really are.
Yes, that it has been, I don't know, it's touched me in a way that it's just different. I think it's just,
yeah,
it's unexplainable, I think.
I think each of these cases, they have a different way that, you know, that they touch our hearts. And so it is hard to explain what it is about each one and just makes us feel so close to them. And one last thought for now. I feel it's so important for you to hear what a special man and beautiful soul CJ was and what an impact he's made on so many people. But just as important, and I can't emphasize this enough, I hope that every single person who had a part in CJ leaving this world will listen to CJ's episode and feel the pain and sorrow and guilt for whatever part they played in this. And I hope and pray that those people grow a strong conscience and come forward, either directly or indirectly, so that CJ's family can have definitive answers that they deserve so that CJ can be at rest finally.
That was well said. We are still actively sifting through records and messages received in response to CJ's story. With a substantial amount still on our plate and an ongoing schedule for additional calls, we've chosen to bring CJ's episode to a conclusion after the holiday break. So look forward to the third part of CJ's story set to unfold when Unforgotten returns at the end of January. Your patience is sincerely appreciated, and we invite you to stay tuned for the continuation of CJ's journey. So just to recap where in CJ's story we left off in part one. Over the summer of 2020, friends and family sensed a change in CJ's behavior and overall demeanor. Little did they know that July 28, 2020 would unravel a sequence of events that would alter their lives forever. CJ, disappointed by the events of the day with his apparent girlfriend Tiffany, found himself pouring his heart out to his mother, April. Tiffany's failure to show up as planned and her questionable story had left him heartbroken. As they sat on the porch, CJ confessed a haunting secret. A substance abuse problem had taken a hold of him. He and April engaged in a heartfelt conversation about the steps he needed to take in his journey towards recovery. April stayed by her son's side until he fell asleep that night, and then she and her husband, Carrie, meticulously combed through their home, ensuring no drugs lingered in any hidden spots. The following morning, April went into CJ's room to check on him and discuss work. She had decided to take CJ's car keys with her to make sure he didn't go anywhere. She was concerned over his mental state and kind of vulnerability and just wanted to ensure his safety and well-being. So with his keys in tow, she left for work. However, as the day unfolded, it became clear that something was amiss. CJ's responses to April's messages dwindled, and by mid-afternoon, he seemed to have vanished from all contact. And when she arrived home that afternoon, CJ was nowhere to be found. What unfolded over the next 10 weeks was a search for any sign of CJ, starting with an anxious sweep around the Chaffins property and desperate pleas on social media, urging CJ to call or anyone who had seen or talked to him, before expanding those searches to neighboring properties, woods, and nearby streams. It was during these searches that CJ's boots and phone were found off the side of Center Church Road / Calico Road. But it wouldn't be until October that CJ's remains were found.
So let's back up a little bit and talk about CJ's activities throughout July 29th, 2020, the last day that CJ was seen, based on the phone records that we've reviewed in our conversations with April and Mariah. At 5:45 a.m., April went in to check on CJ before she left for work. She decided to take his keys, as we mentioned, with her to work, but she knew he was scheduled to work that day with Shane. She told CJ to contact Shane to see if he could ride with him to work, and if not, to let him know that he wouldn't be able to make it in today. CJ was scheduled at work at 7 a.m., but he never showed up. At 8:06 a.m., CJ sends April a text asking, "Where's my keys?" At 9 a.m., Shane received a text from CJ asking, "Where you at?" Shane didn't hear anything else from CJ after that. At 11:38 a.m., April sees the earlier text from CJ and responds, "You all right?" To which CJ responds, "Yeah." April sends another text to CJ, "Rhonda can't cut your hair today, be tomorrow." CJ then sends April a text, "WYA," as we mentioned in the previous episode, "Where you at?" The screenshots of the messages between April and CJ only show the 11:38 timestamp before the "you all right," which leads us to believe that the messages sent were fairly close in time, as the next message April sent to CJ shows a timestamp of 3:06.
And, you know, we talk about this in a little bit, that as far as we know, the general consensus, at least as of the time, was that CJ probably left around 2 p.m. But I look at this message that he sent to April at 8:06 a.m. asking, "Where's my keys?" And to me, he has somewhere that he wants to go. Mm-hmm. Either somebody has contacted him, or I'm not sure what would have prompted that outside of he was up, he was moving around, or maybe not even him, because we actually talk about this in a little bit, because she had just talked to him, you know, but what, like 2 hours earlier, yeah, and told him, "I'm taking your keys with me." So he knew that she had the keys.
Right.
So the short kind of blunt messages seem kind of odd to me. The fact that he was supposed to be at work at 7, but he doesn't text Shane until 9.
And they just talked about that just right before. Yeah.
Right. And I get that maybe, especially if you're going through withdrawal type symptoms, maybe your mind isn't thinking clearly.
Or emotionally, maybe he just wasn't there. You know what I mean? Sometimes when
exactly.
you have a lot going on, your brain just doesn't process the same way.
But I think we'll get into this more in a little bit about why these messages from him to these people asking where he at are really kind of strange.
Right.
You know, like April said in the clip, she didn't even know what that meant. And CJ didn't typically send acronym messages like that, at least to her.
Not to her, yeah.
Because he probably knew she didn't understand what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
I get text messages from my son all the time, and I'm like, what?
What does that mean? I have to. I don't have too many people that do that to me anymore. But like, if I'm reading things from other people for cases or whatever, and they use those kinds of things, I have to go
they
Google.
Use ALR for all right now.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. That's just lazy.
I thought it was autocorrect being messed up. I'm not sure what you're telling me.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sold on the time that he left home. And there's a couple of reasons for that. So we'll get into that. But I just kind of want everybody to like think about that. The first message that April gets from CJ is at 8 o'clock. And I probably should have mentioned when I was writing this part of it, I probably should have put this further up and I don't mention it until further down. One thing that we don't have or haven't seen, and we're hoping to see it later, maybe over the break, are the records from CJ's text messages.
Yeah.
We have his call records, but we don't have his text records. So I would like to see if he was texting anybody in this time period, because the first phone call record, and we know it's the first phone call record because it's the first page, it's denoted by the call as one. So it's clearly the first page, is at 11:44 a.m. So either that is the start of the phone period of the records requested, or that's the first call he actually made.
Right.
Didn't have any calls come in. And to me, that seems kind of odd, too. But if he was just texting people that morning, then maybe, I mean, I don't necessarily like talking on the phone if I don't have to. I would rather send text messages. I have a reason for doing that. It's probably the legal side of me coming out. I like things being in writing.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people that have, you know, you have different reasons for wanting to talk versus wanting to text, you know, so it's very possible he wasn't in the mood to be talking on the phone.
Younger people tend to text message more anyway.
They do, yeah.
You know, I half the time can't get my son to pick up the phone, even though we've had this conversation 100 times about if I call you, you answer the phone. Because he'll turn around and then he'll text message me.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
So it could be that, you know, he was just sending messages. We know he was sending messages. Obviously, there are messages before 11:44. Mm-hmm. But I would like to see those text records, too. So
Ditto.
I'm hoping that's something we'll get in over the break. So at 11:44 a.m., a 23-second outgoing call was made from CJ's phone to a person that we're going to call AB. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to say that a call was made from CJ's phone because, to be honest, we actually don't know whether CJ was making these phone calls. We don't know whether CJ was sending these text messages. And I probably should have phrased that when I said CJ sent this text message or CJ responded, that somebody responded from CJ's phone. And this will all make sense later. But the thing is, there's no witness to say, yes, I saw CJ with his phone. He was using it. You just have to assume, because it's his phone, that he had it. But other than the fact that that was literally his phone, there's no proof CJ had his phone.
Exactly. Yep.
So we're just going to say a call was made from his phone. We're not going to say he didn't make it or that he did, because we just don't know. At 11:47 a.m., another outgoing call was made from CJ's phone to AB. At 1:42 p.m., 4 back-to-back outgoing calls were made from CJ's phone to his Uncle Shane. It doesn't look like the first two calls have a duration time, which I think means they failed to connect. The third outgoing call shows a duration of 3 seconds, and looking at the corresponding AT&T codes, it appears this call went straight to voicemail. Considering the length of the call, we're assuming the call was terminated without leaving a message.
Yeah, and plus Shane said that he hadn't heard from him, so
right.
I think he would have remembered getting a message.
Exactly. The fourth outgoing call appears to have had similar results as the third, because it only lasted 3 seconds as well. The code doesn't indicate that it went straight to voicemail, but that's what it looks like. The time limits match up. So right. It doesn't look like it was answered. Now, the one thing, though, that I did notice about these records that really kind of bothered me, you know, outside of the fact that we don't have the text records,
right,
is that these records look like the subpoena records you would get if you were a lawyer.
Yep.
They do not look like the law enforcement records. They don't include the location data from where the phone calls were made or what tower he was pinging off of. And that bothers me. Now, you can see later in some of the documents that we got, it does look like they did maybe do some cell phone tower pings, but
that's just in their notes and things, right?
It's just a random piece of paper that doesn't really tell you anything.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of questions about that stuff, but when do I not have a lot of questions?
But just, well, we have people to talk to, so I'm hoping that, like you said, that we'll get more of that information.
So this is just going based off the call records that we have. So it's a little bit of a more limited timeline than what we would like to have, but it does give us some insight, you know, that somebody at least, presumably CJ, was actively using his phone during this time period. April took a different route home than the usual due to road construction on Alabama 129 in Brilliant and arrived home from work just after 3 p.m. When she got there, CJ was nowhere to be found and things just seemed out of place.
I know his bed clothes was just all wadded up there by his bed, and I thought, well, maybe he may have gotten sick and stuff. I looked at it with nothing. And his cigarettes was still, his cigarette pack was still laying by his bed. And the phone charger was laying by the door. And the front door, the big door was open, the screen door was shut. And the back door was open to the utility room. I thought he was home because when I come in, you know, I found all that stuff. And I thought, well, he's probably outside. So I went outside looking and I went and looked at my mother's double wide that sits down from us here. But the door was open on one of the buildings. And I went in there, you know, I went into both everywhere just hollering for him and stuff to see if he was in there or what was going on or anything. And I couldn't find him.
At 3:06 p.m., April sent a text to CJ's phone. Where are you and who are you with? She contacted Austin Sprinkle, a friend of CJ's that she also worked with, to see if he'd heard anything from CJ. Austin stated he'd received a text from CJ's phone around 2:37 p.m. asking what he was doing. Austin replied, and he received a message in response from CJ's phone stating he was trying to sober up. Austin told April later he questioned whether the messages he'd received had actually been sent by CJ.
Is that something he did a lot, April, that you remember? Or?
No, I thought he was mad. And I thought, well, I just won't, you know, mess with him anymore.
But that wasn't something that he would normally send to you?
Mm-mm. Nope. That's the reason I thought something else. And I got thinking when I went to the station, I thought, God, you idiot. Well, Austin Sprinkle has said, I don't think that was CJ. I said, I don't know.
So that's part of the reason why I question the time period that he actually left the house and the messages that were being sent, because you have April saying he didn't normally send those acronyms. And then you've got somebody else who presumably talks to CJ saying, I'm not really sure that the messages that I got from him, from his phone were him. Actually, they just seemed kind of odd.
Yeah.
We did ask April to check with Austin to see if he could remember the exact message that he got, because I'm extremely curious as to whether or not the the text messages that Shane received and the text messages that Austin received said WIA or right. was or it word, written wordings. Out?
Yeah.
And did he ask Austin or whoever what he was doing, or did he also ask him where he at?
Right. Yep. Well, over an hour later, April's text to CJ was still unanswered. And so at 4:25 p.m., she began calling and calling, each call going unanswered. At 5:55 p.m., it seems that two outgoing calls were placed from CJ's phone to April's phone. But it doesn't appear that either ever were successfully connected, as the duration for both calls is 0 minutes and 0 seconds, marking that the last outgoing call that we know of at this time. After that, it appears all incoming calls to CJ's phone began going to voicemail. At 6:01 p.m., April sends another text to CJ. Where are you? When she received no response 2 hours later, she resumed her attempts to call CJ again, receiving no answer. By 1 a.m., Shane had been calling CJ as well, but his calls were also going to voicemail. April and Mariah were told by Lieutenant Billy Pendley of Marion County Sheriff's Office that CJ's phone had a significantly low battery when he left April and Carrie's home on the 29th, which they believe was somewhere around 2 p.m., as we talked about earlier. On August 14th of 2020, April told WBRC that CJ's phone was off around 2:22. This is information that she was relayed to by Marion County Sheriff's Office in talking about all the calls that had come in or out of the phone and, you know, that the phone had gone dead.
But they said his phone went off like at 2:22.
According to Billy, somehow they could tell that he left home with it only 4% charged. Phone had 4% battery on it. And he was trying to make, not calls, but he was something like calling his friends through Snapchat. They didn't say that he was asking for help or anything. But they couldn't really talk to him because like they were at work or something like that. So it's like he was trying to call them. And I'm not really sure what he was calling them for. But Snapchat will really drain your battery.
We do now know for sure that the phone wasn't dead at 2:22 p.m. We see that there's calls on the call record. So,
yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't have CJ's text records, as we mentioned, to add to the timeline. Although CJ, at a minimum, sent text to April, Shane, and Austin before all communication seems to have stopped, and that there seems to have been at least one attempt to make an outgoing call from CJ's phone to April at 5:55 p.m. So again, phone not dead at 2:22 p.m. When we take all of the above into consideration, even without having the text records, it raises one important question for us. If CJ's phone battery was dead by 2:22 p.m. or even 2:30,
or even 3,
how was CJ or someone able to attempt two outgoing calls to April roughly 3.5 hours later?
That bugs me.
It bugs me too.
Even if the calls didn't connect, they're still there. They're in the records. It happened. You mm-hmm. see it.
Yep.
Over the next several days, family and friends would continue calling CJ's phone, each one getting the same result. No answer. They made pleas on Facebook urging CJ or anyone with information on his whereabouts to contact April or the Marion County Sheriff's Office. A clerk at a Chevron in Brilliant thought they had seen him at the gas station, but when the surveillance tapes were reviewed, that turned out not to be true. There were rumors he was spotted in Gulf Shores or that he was with someone helping him sober up.
I was told that he went to the beach or something like that. I heard somebody saw him at the beach and I couldn't believe it. And then they really brought a search team out here and
When no one had heard from or seen CJ by August 3rd, April officially filed a missing person report with Marion County Sheriff's Office. The copy of the missing person report we have was inadvertently cut off along the edges. So we're missing maybe the first word of each sentence. So it's not a lot.
Right.
So we can kind of fill it in based on the context. and just general knowledge, but right. also probably shouldn't assume. That's probably bad. investigative skills, just assuming we know what that word is. But just below the initial statement April gave when filing the report, there's a note from the Marion County Sheriff's Office that appears to have no time or date stamp. So we don't know if it came in the same day that the report was filed. We don't know if it came in later during the searches. And I'm really curious about this because if it came in the day the report was filed, I want to know how this person knew to contact the sheriff's office. Because yeah. the report wasn't filed until like 3:56 p.m.
Yeah.
It indicates that a woman with the last name of Smith called the Marion County Sheriff's Office and reported seeing a man matching CJ's description Thursday evening walking down Center Church Road in work pants, a t-shirt, boots, and a hat. Smith believed the male was obviously under the influence and stated he sat down where she and her family were and said he was walking to the Dollar General. Smith said the incident scared her children, so they left the area. One of the words cut off on the page is the name of the road Smith identified just prior to Center Church Road. But Center Church Road is listed in parens following it. So based on conversation with April and others and the media reports at the time, our understanding is that the sighting was reported to have occurred on Calico Road. But she could have called it something different. I feel like if April had seen it, if April had seen a different road when she saw the report, she probably would have told us. That would have stood out to her. So I'm just going to go with more likely than not, it said Calico Road.
Yeah.
It's unclear where exactly on Calico Road Smith and her family were, as Calico Road is roughly half a mile long, intersects with Center Church Road, and has several homes on it. From what I can tell, Smith had relatives on Calico Road, so my assumption is she was probably...
They're very close to their, yeah.
At one of those relatives' homes. Actually, there's a lot of people that we'll discuss in the next episode that are all kind of related in that area, which is part of the reason why I would really like to know when the call came in about this sighting.
Yeah, agreed. On August 4th, Marion County, along with multiple other agencies and numerous volunteers, began searching the area where CJ was last reported to be seen. During the search, April received a call from CJ's aunt, Rhonda, saying that his phone and boots had been found off Calico Road. According to a post from Secrets True Crime on August 5th, they were found underneath a tree about 6 feet off the side of the road.
And was out there searching, you know, out to the area where he was supposed to have been seen at. And my husband fell down in that little creek thing. I mean, he just went, all I seen his head and he just went down. And I was worried about him and stuff. And then I thought there, at first it's kind of funny, but I was trying to get him up. And we got back to the Jeep and we got to call because Rhonda had called me, his aunt, and said that they had found his boots and phone on Center Church Road. I said, where? I said, we're out here on Center Church Road. And she said it's out from or to the end of the road, not the end of the road, but going out that way up on the ditch. On the ditch or something by a tree. When I got there, his friends was out there, and his boots, the way they were set up there up on that hill and stuff, I was looking at them. I was like, you know, it's not left, right, it's right, left. Anyway, I was thinking, you know, we couldn't touch anything, and how I wanted to pick up that phone, you know, I wanted to know, and I didn't. We just kept going, walking back, and they was hollering for him on one side of the road. His friends were, and we were hollering on the back side of the road. And my husband asked him, you know, he's coming back down because Billy had called me or was trying to call me. He had come up, and he said, I've been trying to get in touch with you. I said, I've been out here. I must not have had service, you know. I said, and Rhonda must have got through. I said, but we've been out here looking. And they was telling him how they picked up his phone when his friend had drove by and he'd seen a reflection off his phone. The money was in the road, they said. His shirt was off in the woods, I think.
At the time of him first, you know, not being around, it didn't really raise any concerns. I remember I just got off work, got home. It was dark. And I just got out of the shower, and Corey called me, and he said that Levi and Sprinkle found CJ's boots and cell phone. And that immediately raised a flag. So I threw my jeans on, threw my boots on. I was out the door. At the time, I didn't live but probably 2 miles from CJ's parents' house. I lived about a mile from where he would come up missing. It took me no time to get over there. From that moment, I knew it was a whole lot more serious than what anybody had expected. CJ didn't go anywhere without his cell phone charged. He was a very prepared person. Number two, CJ never took his boots off. We could go over to a buddy's house, and if CJ was sleeping, CJ was sleeping in his boots. We all picked on him a lot. You take showers and those things too. Like your feet need to breathe, brother.
Before we had done the search, this was, Billy coming to the house, informing Mom of what was going on. That he had talked to the neighbor and saw CJ walking on that road. And that's kind of how we had an indicator. That's like the best, information we had gotten at that point, right? Because the neighbor had actually saw him, and they knew who he was, right? Lived next to each other. You kind of know who he is, what he looks like. So he's like, yeah, he definitely walked down the road. And then that kind of told us that was where we knew in that vicinity he was at. And everything else that we searched was just us just guessing, or somebody had said something. But there was a lot of searches. But I know that going back to my point was, when I was calling Mom trying to figure out what was going on, because I had to be back to work back here in Huntsville. So I lived in Huntsville at the time as well. And so, I was just over the phone trying to figure out what was going on, if I need to go down there, if I need to stay, and then, of course, they found his boots and stuff. And, when I got that call that they had found his boots, I thought, wait a minute, are they about to tell me that they found him too? But not in a good way. And so it was nerve-wracking because, when you find his belongings out in the middle of nowhere on this dirt road, and it's like, what? And so then your mind just starts going like, oh my gosh, all these scenarios happen.
There was a lot in that period of time from us finding the boots until he was finally found that raised a lot of red flags to me, with our local law enforcement. A particular property owner in the area that he went missing. I wasn't the only one that caught on to this stuff, but nobody else really wanted to say anything about it.
The search efforts would continue over the next 10 weeks. The searches included aerial searches with helicopters and drones, canine searches, volunteers on foot, four-wheelers, ATVs, and side-by-sides. While the searches failed to turn up information on CJ's whereabouts, they did begin to raise suspicions about what occurred the day he was last seen.
And that's when they were trying to get dogs and trying to get a search together with the fire department. And they were suited up, and they was wanting, a friend of ours had got the fire department from Hamilton to bring the drones out. Because that Wednesday morning, they were telling everybody not to go on that opposite side of the road, that everybody was going to search on the side where his boots were found. And they walked 4.5 miles, and I don't know how each way they went, because I was here at the house. And they said they didn't really want no one on the other side of the road, because it had done been checked with a fine-tooth comb, from what we were told. And they told us about the drones that, they couldn't find anything with those drones. Okay, these drones are supposed to be, they're 3D. Like if somebody touched a leaf, it was showed that infrared. They're supposed to be, big and everything. They've done them on both sides of the road. We waited on it that night, and they was getting the search ready for in the morning, and they didn't want nobody out there. And my husband says, well, you better mark this off. Keep it marked off. And they were supposed to have been doing that, and my husband was trying to get me to come home, and I didn't want to come home. And there were some that was going to stay out there, and there's some of them that did stay out there later and was going to help look. But from that point on, I don't know what else had happened. My insight now, I think there was more to it.
So the bloodhound, now Dixie was the bloodhound, right?
Yeah, both of the tracking dogs are bloodhounds.
I remember her being involved, and Beth, of course, we all met at Mom's house. They got the dogs ready because there was cadaver dogs, bloodhounds, they're part of the Huntsville Dog and Rescue and Equisearch, because Beth was almost like a part of EquiSearch, Beth and Daisy and Dixie, they were part of the EquiSearch, but she's also just kind of like, she will go and help people search on her own. You know, she don't have to be a part of EquiSearch to do so. So,
and that's how Huntsville was. They were good to, they said anytime that we needed them out there to let them know.
Yeah, Beth was super helpful. But she was the one that went up to the house and had Dixie smell CJ's stuff and get his scent. And then she just took off, right, Mom? She just kind of took off from the house.
You know, she come in and got his scent. She walked all around the property and she smelled us and, you know, like they're trained to do.
Yeah, it's a way to make sure she's focused on his scent and then takes away our scent. I don't know how that works, but apparently that's how they set it up to where it's she's only focused on his scent, really.
And when she took off, she took off.
Yeah.
And that one that was helping her, he says, I don't know how she keeps up with her. He says, I don't know how she went as far as she did for. She just, you know, they had to let her rest.
I mean, if you imagine, I mean, this is still hot. It is at Alabama in the South. And, you know, Daisy is walking this long track. She still got his trail all the way from the house, and she was so tired, but, you know, Beth, you know,
she wanted to work it.
She wanted to work it. She really wanted to work it. So Beth had to force her to just, you're going to have to relax. You're overheating. So here they are, hot, and this is still hot, and you get to imagine what CJ walked through. You know, he's walking down this trail, and it's hot, and it's exhausting, and, you know, and it's even hotter because this was like July, you know, towards the end of July. So it's super hot and into August. So, but she did really well. And then we had EquiSearch come out. And the next searches, we were always focused on that road. And then it just seemed like it was going nowhere. So then at that point, it's like, did he go somewhere else? Because then we had people tell us, you know, these maybe possible rumors that he was, oh, we seen him here. Or what if he was on the road? Somebody accidentally hit him with a car and he's in ditches. And that was the last search, I believe, with EquiSearch. Maybe it was the second.
Yes, last. That was the last search.
We were searching the ditches all through the whole main road. We were searching the ditches at that point.
Yeah, and all the way to the house. You know, we had done that ourselves, too.
Mm-hmm. We were with them.
They was just more discreet than what we could have done to having more people. They kept going back out to that one place with Dixie that day. You know, their dog had went, okay, on their search that Wednesday, their dog had went to that red gate and they said she lost her sense. That's what they said.
So from the time that we started our first search, this guy was riding back and forth, up and down, constantly monitoring everybody. And, you know, he didn't really have anything on his property. It was just a bunch of wood and a couple shooting houses. And, you know, the very first thing he said to me and my buddies, you know, when we all met up there to start looking, you know, before we ever had our first official search, he said, yeah, y'all can search my property, but you won't find him on my property. We looked around for a couple hours. We all departed. And I went home. I hadn't been home long, and his aunt called me and said that she had found CJ's shirt. So I raced back out there. I was like, all right, well, you know, we found a shirt. We know which direction he went. Well, let's go find him. So I get out there. We've got the shirt. We're walking around. We're finding coins flipped upside down. This is completely opposite of the side of the property that he was found on. It was really hilly, rough terrain. Lots of ruts, ditches, briars. But every search, that landowner was coming up. Y'all won't find him on my property. He's not on my property. Well, like, buddy, it sounds like you know where he's at. You know, it was really, really suspicious of me that he kept coming up during the searches and saying the same thing, you know, like almost trying to deter us. And ultimately, he turned out to be right. It wasn't on his property. CJ was found on a property line adjacent to his.
At that time, before I was calling Mom, the investigator was there talking to Mom about what he had found out. And I had already kind of made this list of all the things that I think we need to start doing, because the only thing that had been done that I was aware of was that he was talking to neighbors and he was talking to friends and he was, you know, trying to figure out, pinpoint where CJ was at. So I had went online and done my research and I was like, okay, well, we need to post this on this national missing information database where not only would Brilliant area or Alabama, you know, or the smaller towns would know, but everybody would be aware and get his picture out there and his information. And that way, just in case he winds up in a whole different state, because we all know it can happen, that maybe they can pinpoint and say, okay, maybe this is him. This is what it is. So, and I told him about it, and I was talking to Billy about it. Now, a lot of things Billy was aware of, and a lot of things he actually wasn't, or he wasn't too familiar with. So he would say, well, I'm not too familiar with this national missing database or missing person database, or I'm not too familiar with EquiSearch or all this, but I'm gonna talk to my informants or my people, you know, the rest of his team, and we'll see what we can do. So he didn't completely shut us down from it at that point. You know, at this point, like, it seemed like Billy was trying to really help us here, and we were all on the same page. We're all just trying to figure out what we can do to help this investigation. And so then that's when EquiSearch really, it got brought up to me. And then I had told Billy, I said, look, I don't know if you ever heard of these people or what's going on, but these people help search. They have dogs, they have horses, they have people. And this is what we need, because we don't have that here, you know, in Brilliant. We can't just rely on the community. We also need to get more people involved that know what they're doing and have the resources. And I just listed out a bunch of stuff. I said, listen, I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job here, but I think this is what we need to do. And he was like, okay, I'll talk to EquiSearch. So he's the one who reached out to EquiSearch and got them involved pretty early on, I think. You know, and he was on board at the time. It seemed like he was very much on board at the time. And then it changed.
We called them out. They got out. They all showed up with their side-by-sides and coolers strapped to the back. And one of them made a comment, we're not going to spend all night searching. You know, we're just going to search further than go right. So they show up. They made that one little loop around where his shirt was found. And they loaded up and they took off so that they could go ride and drink and party. Pretty much like that the whole time.
In case you missed it a moment ago, April said the drones used in the search for CJ were allegedly infrared thermal drones, which presumably would have picked up body heat from CJ and even insects. During one of her most vulnerable moments, April found herself targeted by a heartless coward who subjected her to a harrowing experience. The individual relentlessly harassed April, demanding sums of money in the form of gift cards or other electronically transferable means. And I don't know if how many people have heard about these kinds of scams, but that is a really typical way that scam artists will try to get money, because they don't want to just ask for straight up money. Nobody will mail money to them or, you know, go directly from a bank account, but they'll send gift cards.
Yeah. And I guess because they think it's not traceable.
It's not traceable, right?
But you're sending the messages, those are traceable.
Yep.
You know, this actually was something that occurred in the Jessica Hamby case too. They were sending these, I believe, over like Facebook Messenger, and your IP address can be traced.
Yeah, Facebook Messenger is not too smart.
No. And I mean, yeah, I guess you could use a VPN and, you know, tunnel it, but this happens all the time, and it is incredibly...
It's cruel for these families to have to go through that.
And I don't understand what in a person's mind makes them think that it's okay to do this.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not
okay
thing
to do
to,
it
like,
with anybody, but the elderly people, it pisses me off too. But
and you get the, like, the telemarketers or whatever, or like, you know, the things on the gas machines, the skimmers, or whatever.
Yeah.
But this is something where somebody is taking complete advantage of a family that is already going through a traumatic experience. They are terribly worried. They have no idea what's going on, whether they're going to find their loved one, how they're going to find their loved one. And now you've got this jackass that's sending messages threatening them, threatening their loved one, and trying to steal their money on top of it.
Yeah. And every time we talk about it with April, it just...
And she sent us the screenshots of the messages. And it will make you sick.
Yeah.
to see the way that they just continued to hound her about it.
Well, the coercion was tied to the promise of facilitating communication with CJ, obtaining information about him, or securing his release. Obviously, they really thought that they could get away with it because of what we just talked about, that this family is grieving, and the people who are grieving don't think clearly about what these kinds of people are doing. They just know that they want their relative, you know.
And April talks about it in the clip that we'll play in just a minute, but you know, she was one of those family members that she went and bought some of these cards because she really wanted to believe that no one would be that cruel and that heartless, and that if she really did what they were asking her to do, she would get this information on her son.
Yeah.
And it wasn't real.
No, not at all.
I got a text. Actually, I got the text earlier than that lunchtime, but that's when I looked at my phone at work, and it had told me they had had my son, and they was telling me what a bad person I was, and the first text, and that they had him. And I know I tried to call that number all the way to the car, and then I got this text back, and they were cussing me like a dog, and asking for the ransom, or, you know, that they had had him, they had him drugged up. And so I left work, and I think my husband called me the time I got to the Chevron, because they must have already known where I had left work and stuff. They wanted $7,000. Of course, you know, I told him I had it. And something about those game cards, they was wanting them game cards, and that store didn't have them. And then Tom was going to Walmart, and then I done bought a couple of them and everything, and then sent it to him. And of course, then Jeff Davis must have got in touch with my husband and stuff and told us not to, you know, to cut it off. These people were just doing this to scam. And we sat at the police station for the rest of that evening, you know, listening to these texts and stuff and waiting on them to text back and stuff. You know, that's what we were told, is because what was supposed to have happened to him, so they were holding him because of money. And they had another caller that would come on too now, not a caller, but another text, like they were investigators. And that her name was Molly. And just stay on the line. We've almost got them. Well, that's a scam. And it's like I told him, I said, well, if you've got my son, then you FaceTime me. Let me see him, you know, let me hear his voice or something other. And they had some kind of video recording thing. It didn't even make no sense to nothing. And then they told me to go on back to work.
Scam artist, but also just terrorist to me. I think they're more of a terrorist type. And like they, you know, they do this. Like, I guess they just sit in their houses or these places and just call up anybody trying to get money, especially from a grieving mother trying to find her son. These people are not people. These people are horrible, evil people. But it's good to know for the families out there that if they're in this situation and if somebody's texting or calling saying that they have their loved one and they're keeping them, just keep in mind that you really need to see that loved one. You need to hear that loved one before you ever send any money, and you need to call the law right away. And anybody could fail for this, because this is a desperate time. We're trying to find CJ, our loved ones. We're almost, it's like you're very vulnerable. And they know that. And they know it. And that's why they play off of that. They call her these names because they already know she feels guilty. She feels bad. So they know that. And so they feed off of it like animals.
They also text CJ's cousin and threaten to kill her kids.
Yes, they were trying their best to get a hold of anybody and just say horrible things, make them feel even more vulnerable than they already do, and then try to take money from them. So any families out there that, you know, are in our situation, be weary. Just know that these people exist. There are really bad people out there.
The search for CJ finally came to an end on October 8th. When his remains were found less than a quarter mile off Center Church Road, which appears to be about halfway between the areas where the tracking dogs had trailed multiple times, The same area that had reportedly been searched with a fine-tooth comb. The same area that had been searched with infrared thermal drones and helicopters and volunteers on foot, all of which turned up empty.
When I was coming home, I could see the helicopter, and I had stopped and got me and my husband something to eat at the barbecue place in Brilliant. And the guy says, they're out looking for that boy. They've got the National Guard out there. I said, oh, they do? And I said, that boy's my son. And he said, I'm so sorry. He said, they're going to find him. They're going to find him. So, yeah, I'm rushing home, you know, and I'd seen, I'd got just past where the Calico part on that side of the road coming home off of that Center Church Road, and the law was coming. I mean, the SUVs was coming like crazy. But, you know, there's been so much of that going on. I always thought it was about CJ, and I thought, well, you know, maybe it's not. I said, I'm just going to go on to the house. By the time I got here, I'd got a shower, and I got out of the shower, and the law was here beating on the door. And when they come in, and they, you know, because I told them, I said, just give me a minute, because I had to get dressed. And opened the door up, and, you know, I thought, well, you know, I guess they found him. And I thought, well, yeah, the law's been out there. In my mind, I'm thinking, you know, when they come up, you know, they're telling me, you know, Billy's telling me to sit down. And they was telling me they found him. They found CJ. I said, you did? Where? And then they was telling me, because, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, I knew they were searching other places. You know, I would have never expected to be out there. And I don't think nobody believed he would have been out there.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's where our main searches were every single time. Yeah, we veered off here and there just to see if he had gotten a little bit farther than what we thought. But our main searches were on that road near his stuff.
Yeah, around everything else. But when I got here, because, you know, I'm like, where? I just couldn't believe it. This is what they told me. Across the road from his boots on this side of the gravel pit. So I'm thinking he fell down somewhere off of that little ditch there and hit his head. And I'm thinking, you know, all this has been searched. And I was thinking, where? You know, and I kept saying where, and it's what he was telling me. And I said, okay, how'd it happen? You know, if he didn't fall, hit his head, how'd it happen? Oh, he got caught up in all that thicket out there. And he's like, he was rude. I mean, so rude Billy was when he said he got caught up in all that thicket out there. Because I first asked about the autopsy. There was no reason to have an autopsy. And I looked at Jamie Bozeman. I said, an autopsy. And he just put his head down like this and kind of rubbed his pants. And that's it. I said, all of this and all this time and all these searches, I'm telling you, you know, we need to have this autopsy done. And he just kept saying, no, there's no reason to have it done. He just got caught up out there in all that thicket, all wrapped up in all that thicket. You know, to me, I'm just, you know, I keep saying, you know, he wasn't by himself. He wasn't by himself. And all these rumors, and Jeff said, people's going to tell you things like that. But I just, you know, not knowing, I mean, I couldn't believe nothing they said. And I still don't believe nothing they say. And this lady told me, she says, the ones that had let us borrow equipment, that his uncle and them, they were out there late at night searching. Every night for nights on end, you know, and his friends and, you know, family and friends was out there. And I think it got to the point where they knew that everybody wasn't out there, because all around where they told me he was found, we didn't know exactly where he was found until the landowner had showed my husband, which was by a shooting house. And it's probably not 10, maybe 12 feet from that shooting house where he was found. And we even had EquiSearch. They went out there on their own to find out where he was and where they had found him. They said there was no markings. Nothing was, no tape was put up. And it's like nothing was there.
As you heard earlier, friends and family had already become somewhat suspicious when CJ's boots and phone were found on Calico Road. You also heard that those suspicions were heightened when the landowner was insistent that CJ's body would not be found on his property.
Derek Tesney owns land where CJ's remains were found. Across the road is his father-in-law's land.
You know, another thing that was interesting too was, you had mentioned it and I didn't interrupt you. See how that works? I'm just kidding.
It's okay, because your soapboxes are pretty important. And we both feel them. You're just really great at conveying that soapbox feel.
Oh, Well, the infrared thermal drones.
Yeah.
You know, April said they flew these infrared thermal drones. And I tried to research this, too, to see if there were, like, any kind of studies showing how long heat signatures would be picked up on deceased bodies. Like, I'm assuming it would probably be for a while.
I was going to say, as long as they create heat. No, and I don't want to get too graphic about this, but, you know, over time, the body still creates heat because of the processes it goes through.
Right. And well, and that's the, that was kind of the point of the insects. Over the course of decomposition,
right,
insects will start to, you know, gather and cluster, and they'll also pick up on the insects.
Yep.
And so they've flown helicopters. They've flown literally infrared thermal drones over these areas.
Right.
All and granted, around where CJ was last seen.
Yeah. Okay? And granted, you know, if you're on foot, that's a lot of area to cover, but a drone with thermal, I have a hard time feeling that it wouldn't have picked up anything.
And we went back on the Google timeline, like on the Google archive photos on the satellite view.
Yep.
And you, yes, it's grown up through there, but you can still see things that are on the ground. Barely. I mean, we only have like, I think it goes from like 2019 to 2022. But like, it's not like you have to like really look to see the roof of a house.
And it's or a lot more like that. Now than it was then. So,
yeah. So in a helicopter or something like that, you would think you would be able to see that because they would have been flying much lower than what we're looking at and have a higher quality image, obviously, because they're looking at it. Yep. And then you throw in the infrared thermal drones, and I find it hard to believe that they just somehow missed it for 10 weeks. They just somehow missed CJ for 10 weeks.
And it wasn't just one search.
No.
So.
From CJ's boots and cell phone to where his remains were found was almost a mile walk barefoot down a dirt road through an area with pines and other deciduous evergreens and briars. And if you're not someone who ventures into the outdoors very often, it is not a place you want to be barefoot. Lieutenant Penley even described the area as a thicket. That's what he told April was he just got caught up in the thicket. So when I hear thicket, I think of like briars and brambles and grown up. And during the summertime, when everything's still green and, you know, it's not dying off where you can walk through, it really is. Because when we go up to our hunting camp and we're like going out to, you know, feed the deer or whatever we're going to do, it really is super grown up because, you know, the greenery is growing up, whatever you call that in the bottom of, you know, it's not grass. But there's lots of things that poke you and sticks and rocks and, you know, all of this stuff. You don't want to be walking through there without shoes on. They find his boots and his phone. And then a little ways up, they find his shirt and some coins and some money and one sock. Where's the other sock?
Yeah, we never did really hear her.
It was just the one. As far as I know, there was only one, some chapstick.
Yeah, Carmex.
When his remains were found, Lieutenant Penley told April he still had his jeans on. There was a little bit of a discrepancy, though, which is something that we're hoping to clarify over the break. SBI agent Jamie Bozeman told April that CJ's wallet was in his pants pocket. And then when she asked Lieutenant Penley about it, Lieutenant Penley said, no, that was out beside him.
Yeah.
And little things like this may not seem like a big deal, but they're a big deal.
Everything matters.
It does matter because were they in his pocket? Were they not in his pocket? Is there something you can get DNA off of? Did somebody take it out? Did they throw it out? Because it sounds like somebody just threw his stuff out, you know? And where's the other dang sock? It just bothers me.
Yeah.
To CJ's family and friends, it seemed too out of character and too unlikely.
I don't believe CJ walked that far in the woods. And I don't, it don't matter, you know, what kind of drugs he had in his system or what mindset he was in. Nobody is walking through the terrain that they're saying that he walked through barefooted.
I said, I don't believe he walked out there in them woods and just died. He said, well, according to this, he had his case, the case file in his hand. According to this, he did.
While the family's request for an autopsy went unmet, they were told that CJ's personal belongings would be sent to the lab and processed for any potential DNA evidence. However, that evidence was ultimately returned unprocessed.
That's what Billy was telling us. I think this was already after he was found. I had talked to Billy, and I was like trying to figure out what was found DNA-wise on his shirt, his boots, you know, everything that they had supposedly collected. And he said, well, the lab said they were backed up and that he had talked to somebody. He didn't give any names and no position. Didn't really know who, what, when, where. But he just said that the people that he was talking to, that he had sent it to, supposedly, that there was no point because since Billy and them thought it was no foul play, that there was no point of even looking at his belongings for DNA or anything else that the lab might show us or give us any kind of clue. He just said there was no point. I thought the way he was talking to me, kind of tried, like he was trying to convince me that there was no point and that he believed that he had the support from the people at the lab or the forensics lab. That's the way I took it. He said there was no point. And supposedly he had sent it, and then there was no point, so then they just give it all back to Mom.
Well, they didn't give everything back.
Oh, okay. What did they not give back?
They still have his shirt, his boots.
Oh, I thought they give the boots back.
Since no autopsy was performed, CJ's death was classified as the unfortunate undetermined, which is where it remains today.
And that undetermined, I hate that term now. I never really ever paid any notice to it until Jessica's.
Yeah, until Undetermined. The actual series, the Undetermined series.
Yep. And now every time it comes up in an autopsy report or death certificate.
And you get stuck there because, especially mm-hmm. when there's not an autopsy and there's already been a burial, because then you have to go through all these hoops to have a body exhumed to try to get mm-hmm. an autopsy. And then you kind of have to hope that it hasn't been too long. And there's just kind of hurdles that you have to jump through to do all of that anyway, including like getting yep. permission from all of these people. And
well, you know, we know a couple of people that have had to go through this, but like Lauren Malloy out of Rhode Island, she's been fighting. Gosh, I can't even remember what her date number of days count is now since they agreed that they were going to exhume her mom. And that took forever just to get to that point. It's a horrible process, and it's a long, long waiting game.
And, you know, I think that in our conversations with April and Mariah, Lieutenant Penley, I think, tried to basically blow them off about it and say, you know, it was hot. He dehydrated, potentially he was going through withdrawals. You know, it was kind of a culmination of all of these things, and it could have been. We're not saying it wasn't. I think there are reasons to look at it, to believe that there could have been other things at play.
Right. There could be other factors involved.
But yeah, he just made this assumption that that's what it was. And I think it's interesting that that was his assumption, but the coroner didn't make an assumption that it doesn't say natural causes.
Right.
It's not like it has like a heat stroke or anything like that. So, and I guess, you know, in a situation like that where it's been 10 weeks and you can't really tell, I mean, I guess you can't put natural causes because.
Yeah. If there's no apparent injuries. Yeah.
And I think in cases like this, there should be. If you're having to put undetermined on a certificate of death, if you're having to put undetermined and there was literally no witnesses to this,
should have been an autopsy.
there should be a requirement to have an autopsy. You know, there needs to be a requirement, and in general, overall, when there is an unexpected death and there are no witnesses, there should be a required autopsy. Wouldn't it be better to do that autopsy just to be on the safe side?
Yeah.
Like, why not? Why have that question hanging over your head and the family's head? Because at the end of the day, it's the family that you're actually working for. To me, it just seems incredibly unfair. And I think he did even maybe say the family didn't request an autopsy, but they are very adamant that they requested an autopsy.
Right.
And it just seems incredibly unfair and insensitive, actually. Because
especially for a family who is so sure that it wasn't just an accident.
And okay, so what happens if it comes back and your theory was proven right? Nothing. They have the answers to their questions. You're proven right, and your case is closed with a more definitive answer than undetermined.
Yep. 100% agree with you.
I mean, and it's not like he's the one performing the autopsy or whatever investigator. It's not like they're going in and performing the autopsy. It's no extra work to them at all. And in CJ's family's case, they offered to like pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if the cost was the thing, because they said he kept bringing up the cost, what it was going to cost. They're like, well, we'll pay for it. And that happens in so many instances where the family's like, well, we'll just pay for it. And that doesn't, it never happens. And I don't understand it. But also, if you have something that you think needs to be done, and this is specifically to the agencies, and you don't have the funding for it, let us know, because we can get you the resources to get you the funding.
Yeah. There's so many out there now that, you know, want to help with these kinds of cases, that there's no excuse anymore. I don't think, you know, and at the very least we'll fundraise for it, you know, if that's the case. So yeah, I'm right there with you. Since 2020, CJ's family has heard various stories about what really happened, and they've continued to push for answers in his case. Earlier this year, April was finally allowed to review CJ's case file at the Marion County Sheriff's Office. With the assistance of a lawyer, April poured through the investigative file, learning more than she knew before and leaving with more questions than she had entered with. Through their review, they learned that at least three people had either been arrested or questioned in connection with CJ's disappearance and death. However, April didn't see their statements and just a note in the file that said they'd been brought in. You mentioned that there was three people that were arrested.
Mm-hmm.
What happened with that?
They must have just made their statements. I really don't know what all had took place, because I've not talked to those people. And I didn't get to see their statements that they had. And we didn't get to go in detail about it.
So how did you find out that they were arrested for this?
From the file.
From the file. Okay. So there was a statement in there. You just didn't see the actual statements from the people.
Yeah, that's what the lawyer took pictures and stuff of.
I think they were probably not arrested, that they were probably just questioned.
Wondering.
They were probably brought in, like picked up for questioning and then released.
Mm-hmm. My guess. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if it was like, I don't know what the note would have said, but maybe brought into custody or something more like that. Then had been arrested, but I don't know. They could have been arrested, and we just don't see the end result. So
interesting. Their statements weren't in there, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least that she saw.
April had also been told that prints were found on CJ's phone belonging to someone other than CJ, and that the individual was supposed to be brought in for questioning and a potential polygraph. Yet when she asked Lieutenant Pendley about this, he said he didn't know what she was talking about and that no prints were found on the phone.
Huh.
Yeah.
And I also asked Billy about the phone, about, you know, we were told there were prints on the phone. And he said no, and he wasn't aware, because I thought that person was supposed to be brought in for a lie detector test, wasn't he? Well, I'm not aware of it. That's what he told me. I was like, okay. And I said, so there weren't no prints on his phone. No prints on his phone. And I looked at the lawyer and I thought, Okay. Wasn't no prints on his phone. Okay.
Presumably, you know, no prints means a total absence of prints, which we know wouldn't be possible if CJ was the last person that had his phone with him, considering he'd been actively using his phone that day when he went missing.
You would think that if he just took his boots off and had his phone down, his prints would have still been on it.
Yep. And his, it was a very warm day. You are secreting all kinds of sweat and all kinds of stuff. There is no way there wasn't something on that phone if he was handling it.
Yeah. But, okay, I'm trying to, like, give the benefit of doubt here and think he means no prints outside of CJ's. But I think he reiterated to her twice, no prints.
Yeah.
He didn't say no prints, but CJ's. He said no prints.
Right.
And, you know, another thing that April had told us about this phone was that when she got it, she actually has it back now. But when she got it back, her understanding was that it actually had not been stored in evidence at the sheriff's office, that it actually had been kept at Billy Penley's house, and that when she got it back, it was like 75% charged or something.
Yeah.
And that to me seems a little bit odd that it wouldn't be
I have stored. No idea why. Yeah.
And then they've got the phone back now, but they don't have his boots, his shirt, those personal belongings that were picked up. And, you know, we were talking to April about it, and we're like, well, if this is technically a closed case, why do they still have those things? You know, is that something that we could potentially, could we find somebody to look at it, you know, help her find somebody to potentially run it for DNA or whatever? Mm-hmm. So it's odd to me that they gave the phone back, but didn't give back
the rest of his stuff.
And there's actually a letter where the evidence really was sent off. Yeah. There's actually a letter from DFS that's on March 31st of 2021 that says William J. Penley with the Marion County Sheriff's Office that no analyses were needed on the items of the above reference case. Evidence in this case will be returned to the investigative or submitting agency. So it was made out to CJ's family that basically he had checked with all of these people and they were told the labs were backed up. And that really, because of the circumstances, there was no point in running all of this stuff for DNA because
basically, there's no foul play. He was saving them time since.
Yeah. And so, like, there was nothing they were going to get off of it, given the circumstances. You know, you have to wonder, though, who said that? Like, who did you talk to that told you that it wasn't worth your time to send that?
Right.
Like, if there were truly no prints on that cell phone that you know he's used, did that not raise some red flags to say, wait, there should have been some prints on here, at least belonging to one person?
Yeah.
And
there were coins found. There was
$9.
I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, I would think it would be hard to, like, get prints off of, you know, clothing, harder to get prints off of clothing, depending on what it is. But in general, there either was prints probably on the coins, I would think, or the money, I guess I would say, or at least a DNA on most of that. Each article has would have a high potential for having some sort of DNA on it, especially in that weather.
At this point, the events of that sweltering July day remain cloaked in uncertainty. A significant number of individuals hold firm to the belief that there are at least a few who possess some knowledge about what transpired.
I believe somebody meant to do him harm. I don't want to think of that. I mean, I didn't want to think that somebody would hurt him, but or take his life.
I think it's more of a wrongful death, and I hate that we're out of that two-year limit to look more into it, but I think it could be more of a wrongful death. I really believe that there is more people involved in this. I believe that whether it's more of a involvement of they just know the information or they were around him to know what happened more than what we do, you know, how involved these people were, that's the big question. But I do think there's other people involved here. Absolutely.
People's asked me what I think happened, and to be honest with you, I just really don't know enough about the situation to really give an opinion on it. And I guess we don't know what happened, but in my opinion, I believe there's people out there that knows what happened.
I'm really stuck on that landowner knowing way more than what he claims to. You know, if he would claim to himself or, you know, even offered to help, you know, it would have been completely different. It never would have crossed my mind, you know, but the fact that he just kept coming back and saying the same thing.
When we return in January, we will be diving into some of the narratives shared with April, coupled with some of the information we've received in response to CJ's case. If you have any information related to the disappearance and death of C.J. Wilkinson, please contact Marion County Sheriff's Office at 205-921-4733 or submit a tip on their website. You can also contact us via email or our social media pages or submit an anonymous tip through our website. Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Spotify for Podcasters, available on your favorite podcast platform. Intro music for the show was created by Principles of Uncertainty, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Content and production is by Sellers and Stormy, artwork by Sellers. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and any source referenced in our podcast can be found in each episode's description. We hope you will join us on all the major social media sites and continue to raise awareness of our Alabama cold cases. Until next time, thank you for listening, and remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.